"Not in the least," said Jack. "Well, now, seeing that anything resembling a direct gratification is out of the question with a gentleman of your kind, where do you get these wild romantic notions?" thought Jack, looking wistfully into his face. "Some members suggested a service of plate, or Suraj ud-Dowla's gold-mounted palanquin, but I put it to them that a service of plate on the scale they suggested would take a year or so to reach your table, that, to my personal knowledge, you were already magnificently supplied with silver." Jack possessed 6 plates at present in pawn. "And that a palanquin, however magnificent, was of little use to a sea officer. And it occurred to me that freight was the answer to our problem. Am I too gross, speaking with this freedom?" "Oh, no, no," cried Jack. "Use no ceremony, I beg." But he was puzzled. Freight money, that charming, unlooked-for, unlaborious, almost unearned shower of gold, fell only on those fortunate captains of men of war who carried treasure for government, or for the owners of bullion or specie who did not choose to trust their concentrated wealth to any conveyance less sure. It amounted to 2 or 3% of the value carried, and very welcome it was, although it was far rarer than prize money, the sea officer's only other road to a decent competence. It was surer. It had no possible legal difficulties attached, and no man had to risk his ship, his life, or his career in getting it. Like every other sailor, Jack knew all about freight money, but none had ever come his way. He felt a glowing benevolence towards Canning. Yet still he was in a state of doubt. Bullion travelled out to India, not back to England. The company's wealth sailed home in the form of tea and muslin, cashmere shawls. He'd never heard of bullion homeward bound. "You may be aware that the Lushington was carrying Borneo rubies, one of our shipments of gems," said Canning. "And we have a consignment of Tinnevelly pearls as well as 2 parcels of sapphires. The whole amounts to no great value, I fear, not even 250,000. But it takes no room either. You'd not be incommoded. May I hope to persuade you to convey it, sir?"
"I believe you may, sir," said Jack, "and I am exceedingly obliged to you for the delicate, gentlemanlike way this offer's been made."
"You mustn't thank me, my dear Aubrey. It's not the least personal obligation. I am only the mouthpiece of the company. How I wish I could be of some direct service.
If there's any way in which I can be of use, I should be most happy. Would it, for example, be of any interest to you to send a message to England? If you were to put a few thousand into Mohair and Mohair futures, you might well clear 30% before you were home. Some cousins and I keep up an overland mail, and the courier is on the wing. He goes by way of Suez." "Mohair futures," said Jack in a wondering voice. "I should be tolerably at sea there, I'm afraid. But I tell you what it is, Canning, I should be infinitely obliged if your man would take me a private letter. You shall have it in 10 minutes. How kind, how very kind." He turned Canning over to Pullings for a thorough tour of the ship, with a particular recommendation that he should view the stringers abaft the manger and the state of the bits, and resumed his letter. "Sophie, dear, here is the prettiest thing in the world. John Company is stuffing the ship with treasure. You and I are to get freight, as we say. Shall explain it to you later. Very like prize, but the men don't share, nor the Admiral neither this time, since I'm under Admiralty orders. Is not that charming? No vast great thumping sum, but it will clear me of debt and set us up in a neat cottage with an acre or 2. So you are hereby required and directed to proceed to Madeira forthwith,
And here is a note for Heneage Dundas, who will be delighted to give you a passage in the Thalian, if he is still on the packet run, or to find one of our friends bound there if he's not. Lose not a moment. You may knit your wedding dress aboard. In great haste, and with far greater love, Jack. P.S. Stephen is very well. We had a brush with Lenoir. Old Heneage, as you love me, give Sophie a passage to Madeira. Or, if you cannot, stir up Close, Seymour, Rue, any of our reliable, sober friends, and if you can ship a respectable woman as, say, boatswain's servant, you would infinitely oblige yours ever, Jack Aubrey. P.S. Surprise had a mauling from Marengo, 74, but paid her back with interest, and the moment her bounties are something like, I put to sea. This comes overland, and I dare say it will outrun me by a couple of months. "Here you are, sir," he cried, seeing Canning's bulk darken the cabin door. "Signed, sealed, and delivered. I'm most uncommon grateful." "Not at all. I shall give it to Atkins directly, and he will take it to the courier before he leaves."
"Atkins?"
"Mr. Stanhope's Atkins."
"Yes, Dr. Maturin gave him a chit for me. It seems that with the envoy dying in that unhappy way, he was out of a place. Are you acquainted with him?"
"He came out in surprise, of course, but really I hardly saw anything of the gentleman."
"Ah, indeed. That reminds me, I've not had the pleasure of seeing Maturin for some days now."
"Nor have I. We meet at these splendid dinners, but otherwise he's busy at the hospital, or running about the country looking for bugs and tigers."
"Be so good as to call me an elephant," said Stephen. "Sigh but once. Does this side prefer a male elephant or a female elephant?"
"A male elephant. I should be more at home with a male elephant."
"Would this side wish me to bring him to a house of boys? Cleaned, polite boys like gazelles that sing and play the flute?"
"No, Mohammed, just the elephant, if you please."
The enormous grey creature knelt down, and Stephen looked closely into its wise little old eye, gleaming among the paint and embroidery. "The sahib places his foot here upon the brute."
"I beg your pardon," murmured Stephen of the Vas. Archaic ear, and mounted.
They rode down the crowded Chowringhi, Mahomet pointing out objects of interest. "There lives Mirza Shah Decrepit, blind. Kings trembled at his name. There Kumar, the rich, an unbeliever. He has 1,000 concubines. The sahib is disgusted. Like me, the sahib looks upon women as tattling, guileful, tale-bearing, noisy, contemptible, mean, wretched, unsteady, harsh, inhospitable. I will bring him a young gentleman that smells of honey. This is the Maidan. The sahib sees 2 peepal trees near the bridge. God give him sight forever. That is where the European gentlemen come to fight one another with swords and pistols. The building beyond the bridge is a heathen temple full of idols. We cross the bridge. Now the sahib is in Alipur."
In Alipur. Vast walled gardens, isolated houses. Here, a Gothic ruin with a true pagoda in its grounds. There, a homesick Irishman's round tower. The elephant padded up a gravel drive to a portico, very like the portico of an English country house, apart from the deep recesses on either side for the tigers, and the smell of wild beasts that hung beneath its roof. They paced out and looked not at, but towards him with implacable eyes. Their chains still dragged upon the ground, yet their faces were so close together that their whiskers mingled, and it was impossible to say from which cavernous chest came the growl that filled the echoing porch with this low, continuous sound. The porter's infant child, woken by the organ note, applied himself to a winch, and the tigers were heaved apart. "Infant child," said Stephen, "state the names and ages of thy beasts."
"Father of the poor, their names are right and wrong. They are of immemorial antiquity, having been in this portico even before I was born."
"Yet the territory of the one overlaps the territory of the other?"
"Maharaj, my understanding does not reach the word overlap, but no doubt it is so."
"Child, accept this coin." Stephen was announced.
"Here's that physical chap again," said Lady Forbes, peering at him under her shading hand. "You must admit he has a certain air, has seen good company, but I never trust these half-castes. Good afternoon, sir. I trust I see you well, my sawbones, Romeo. They've been at it hammer and tongs and thrown in the bloody coal-scuttle, too. She would have reduced me to tears if I had any left to shed. You find me at my tea, sir. May I offer you a cup? I lace it with gin, sir. The only thing against this hot, relaxing, damp Kumar. Where is that black sodomite? Another cup. So, you've buried poor Stanhope, I hear. Ah, well, we must all come to it. That's my comfort. Lord, the young men I've seen buried here. Mrs. Villers will be down presently. Perhaps I'll pour you another cup and then help her with her gown. She'll be lying there, stark naked, sweating under the punkah. I dare say you'd like to go and help her yourself, young fellow, for all your compassé airs. Don't tell me you have no lard. I am a coarse old woman. And to think I was once a girl, alas, alas."
"Stephen, my conquering hero," cried Diana, coming in alone. "How glad I am to see your phys at last. Where have you been all these days? Didn't you have my note? Sit down, do, and take off your coat. How can you bear this wicked heat? We're beside ourselves with stickiness and vexation, and you look as cool as... How I envy you! Is that your elephant outside? I'll have him led into the shade at once. You must never leave an elephant in the sun." She called a servant, a stupid man who didn't understand her directions at once, and her voice rose to a tone that Stephen knew well. "When I saw an elephant coming up the drive," she said, smiling again, "I thought it was that boar Johnston. He's always calling. Not that he's really a boar. An interesting man, in fact, an American. You'd like him. Have you ever met him, an American?" "Nor did I before this. Perfectly civilized, you know. All that about their spitting on the floor is so much stuff. And immensely rich, too. But it is embarrassing and a source of these perpetual goddamn scenes. How I hate a man that makes scenes, particularly in this weather, when the least exertion brings you out in a muck sweat. Everybody's furious in this weather. But what made you come on an elephant, Stephen, dressed in a bloom-coloured coat?" It was clear to a man with far less knowledge of morphology than Stephen possessed that there was nothing under Diana's gown, and he looked out of the window with a light frown. He wished his mind to be perfectly clear. He said, "The elephant stands for splendour and confidence. These last weeks, ever since the ship turned back from the Sumatra coast, I have noticed a look of settled and increasing anxiety upon my face. I see it when I shave. I also feel the set of my features, head, neck, shoulders, the expressive parts. From time to time I look, and again I verify that this is indeed an expression of an indwelling, undefined, and general apprehension, or even dread. I dispel it. I look cheerful and alert, perhaps confident, and in a few moments it is there again. The elephant is to deal with this. You will remember the last time we met I begged you would do me the honour of marrying me."
"I do, Stephen," cried Diana, blushing. He'd never seen her blush, and it moved him.
"Indeed I do. Oh, why didn't you say so long ago, at Dover, say?"
It might have been different then, before all this. She took a fan from the table and stood up, flicking it nervously. "God, how hot it is today," she said, and her expression changed. "Why wait till now? Anyone would say I brought myself so low that you could do something quixotic. Indeed, if I were not so fond of you, and I am fond of you, Maturin. You are a friend I love. I might call it a great impertinence. An affront. No woman of any spirit will put up with an affront. I have not degraded myself." Her chin began to pucker. She mastered it and said, "I have not come down to..." But in spite of her pride, the tears came running fast. She bowed her head on his shoulder, and they ran down his bloom-coloured coat. "In any case," she said between her sobs, "you don't really wish to marry me. You told me yourself long ago. The hunter doesn't want the fox."
"What the devil are you about, sir?" cried Canning from the open door. "What is that to you, sir?" said Stephen, turning sharp upon him. "Mrs. Villers is under my protection," said Canning. He was pale with fury. "I give no explanations to any man for kissing a woman unless it is his wife. Do you not?"
"I do not, sir."
"And what does your protection amount to? You know very well Mrs. Canning will be here in the Hastings on the 16th. Where is your protection, then? What kind of consideration is this?"
"Is that true, Canning?" cried Diana.
Canning flushed deeply. "You've been tampering with my papers, Maturin. Your man Atkins has been tampering with my papers." He stepped forward, and in his passion he gave Stephen a furious, open-handed blow. Instantly Diana thrust a table between them and pushed Canning back, crying out, "Pay no attention, Stephen. He doesn't mean it. It's the heat. He's drunk. He'll apologize. Leave the house at once, Canning. What do you mean by this low, vulgar brawling? Are you a groom, a potboy? You're ridiculous." Stephen stood with his hands behind his back. He, too, was very pale, apart from the red print of Canning's hand. Canning, at the door, snatched up a chair and beat it on the ground. He wrenched the back apart, flung it down, and ran out.
"Stephen," said Diana, "do not notice it. Do not fight him. He will apologize. He will certainly apologize. Oh, do not fight him. Promise me he will apologize."
"Perhaps he will, my dear," said Stephen. "He is in a sad way entirely, poor fellow." He opened the window. "I believe I will go out this way, if I may. I do not altogether trust your tigers." "Captain Etheridge, sir," he said, "will you do me a service now?" "With all the pleasure in life," said Etheridge, turning his round, benevolent face from the scuttle where he held it in the hope of air. "Something happened today that caused me uneasiness. I must beg you to call upon Mr. Canning and desire him to give me satisfaction for a blow."
"A blow?" cried Etheridge, his face instantly changing to a look of profound concern.
"Oh, dear me, no apology in that case, I presume. But did you say Canning? Ain't he a Jew? You don't have to fight a Jew, Doctor. You must not put your life at risk for a Jew. Let a file of marines tan his unbelieving hide and ram a piece of bacon down his throat and leave it at that."
"We see things differently," said Stephen. "I have a particular devotion to Our Lady, who was a Jewess, and I cannot feel my race superior to her. Besides, I feel for the man. I will fight him with the best will in the world."
"You do him too much honour,"
said Etheridge, dissatisfied and upset. "But you know your own business best, of course. You cannot be expected to stomach a blow, and yet again, having to fight a commercial fellow is like being forced into an unequal match or having to marry a maidservant because you've got a with child. Shouldn't you like to fight someone else? Well, I shall have to put on my regimentals. I shouldn't do it for anyone but you, Maturin, not in this damn fleet. I hope he can find a second that understands these things, a Christian, that's all. He went to his cabin, worried and displeased, reappeared in his red coat, already damp with sweat, and putting his head through the door, he made a last appeal. Are you sure you wouldn't like to fight somebody else? A bystander, say, who saw the blow? It might not have quite the same effect, said Stephen, shaking his head. And, Etheridge, I may rely upon your discretion, of course. Now I know what o'clock it is, said Etheridge crossly. As early as possible, I suppose, will dawn suit. And Stephen heard him muttering, obstinate. Don't listen to reason. Pig-headed. As he went down the gangway. What's the matter with our lobster? Asked Pullings, coming into the gunroom. I've never seen him so hellfire grum. Has he caught the prickly heat? He will be cooler and more collected in the evening. On his return, Etheridge was much cooler and almost satisfied. Well, at least he has some respectable friends, he said. I spoke to Colonel Burke of the company's service, a very gentlemanlike man, quite the thing, and we agreed on pistols at 20 paces. I hope that suits. Certainly. I'm obliged to you, Etheridge. The only thing I have left to do is to view the ground. We agreed to meet after the Chief Justice's party when it'll be cooler. Oh, never trouble your kind heart, Etheridge. I shall be content with any usual ground. Etheridge frowned and said, No, no. I do hate any irregularity in affairs of this kind. It's strange enough already without the seconds not viewing the ground. You are too good. I've prepared you a bowl of iced punch. Pray, drink off a glass or so. You've been preparing your pistols, too, said Etheridge, nodding at the open case. I do recommend corning the powder uncommon fine, but I'm not to tell you anything about powder and shot. This is capital punch. I could drink it forever. Stephen walked into the great cabin. Jack, he said, it's weeks since we played a note. What do you say to about this evening, if you're not too taken up with your bollards and capstan bars? Have you come aboard, my plum? Cried Jack, looking up from the bosun's accounts with a beaming face. I have such news for you. We're to carry treasure, and the freight will see me clear.
What is freight?
It means I'm clear of debt. That is news indeed. I give you joy with all my heart. I'm delighted, amazed. I'll explain it to you with figures the moment my accounts are done, but damn paperwork for today. Had you any particular music in mind?
The Boccherini C major, perhaps?
Why, that's the strangest thing. The adagio's been running through my head this last hour and more, yet I ain't in the least melancholy, far from it.
He rosined his bow and said,
Stephen, I took your advice. I've written to Sophie asking her to come out to Madeira. Canning sends it overland. Stephen nodded and smiled, hummed the true note and found it on his cello. They tuned, nodded, tapped 3 times, each with his eye fixed on the other's bow, and dashed away into the brilliant, heart-lifting first movement. On and on, lost in the music, intertwined, a lovely complexity of sound, on through the near desperation of the adagio, on and on with such fire and attack to the very height, and the majestic triumphant close. Lord, Stephen, said Jack, leaning back and laying his fiddle carefully down, we've never played so well.
It is a noble piece. I revere that man.
Listen, Jack, here are some papers I must confide to you. The usual things. I fight Canning in the morning, alas.
A dense curtain fell instantly, cutting off all but formal communication between them. After a pause, Jack said,
Who's your second?
Etheridge.
I'll come with you.
That was why there was all that firing on the quarter-deck, of course. You wouldn't mind it if I were to have a word with him?
Not at all, but he's gone to the Chief Justice's. He's to view the ground with a Colonel Burke after the party.
Never vex your heart for me, Jack. I'm used to these things.
More used to them than you, I dare say.
Oh, Stephen, said Jack, this is a damn black ending to the sweetest day.
This is where we usually settle our affairs in Calcutta, said Colonel Burke, leading them across the moonlight Maidan. There is the road over the Alipur Bridge, you see, conveniently near at hand, and yet behind these trees it is as discreet and secluded as you could wish.
Colonel Burke, said Jack, as I understand it, the offence was not given in public. I believe any expression of regret would meet the case. I have a great esteem for your principal, and I say this out of consideration for him. Pray do all you can. My man is deadly.
Burke gave him a broad stare.
So is mine, he said in an offended tone.
He dropped Harlow like a bird in Hyde Park. But even if he were not, it wouldn't signify. He don't want pluck, as I know very well. I shouldn't be here else. Of course, if your man chooses to put with a blow and turn the other cheek, I have nothing more to say. Blessed are the peacemakers.
Jack commanded himself. There was little hope of piercing through Burke's deep stupidity. But he went on, Canning must certainly have been in wine. The least admission of this, a general expression, will answer. It will be satisfactory, and if need be, I shall use my authority to make it so.
Confine your man to his quarters, you mean? Well, you have your own ways in the Navy, I see. It would scarcely answer with us. I'll carry your message, of course, but I cannot answer for its coming to anything. I've never had a principal more determined to give satisfaction in a regular way. He's a rare Plucton.
In his journal, Stephen wrote, At most times, the diarist may believe he is addressing his future self. But the real height of diary writing is the gratuitous entry, as this may prove to be. Why should tomorrow's meeting affect me in this way? I've been out many, many times. It's true my hands are not what they were, and in growing older I have lost the deeply illogical but deeply anchored conviction of immortality. But the truth of the matter is that now I have so much to lose. I am to fight Canning. Made as we are, it was inevitable, I suppose. But how deeply I regret it. I cannot feel ill-will towards him, and although in his present state of confused passion and shame and disappointment, I have no doubt he will try to kill me, I do not believe he feels any towards me except as the catalyst of his unhappiness. For my part, I shall, sub deo, nick his arm no more.
Good Mr. White would call my sub deo gross blasphemy, and I am tempted to throw down some observations on the matter, but peccavi nimis cogitatione, verbo et opere. I must find my priest and go quickly to sleep. Sleep is the thing, sleep, for the quietened mind.
From this sleep, but a sleep troubled by hurrying, disjointed dreams, Jack woke him at 2 bells in the morning watch. And as they dressed, they heard young Babington on deck singing Lovely Peggy in a sweet undertone, as cheerful as the rising day. They came out of the cabin into the deathly reek laying over the Hooghly and the interminable mud flats, and at the gangway they found Etheridge, M'Alister, and Bomben. Under the peepul trees on the deserted Maidan, a silent group was waiting for them. Canning, two friends, a surgeon, and some men to keep the ground. Two closed carriages at a distance. Burke came forward.
"Good morning, gentlemen," he said. "There is no accommodating the affair. Etheridge, if you are happy that there is light enough, I think we should place our men. Unless, of course, your principal chooses to withdraw."
Canning was wearing a black coat, and he buttoned it high over his neckcloth. There was light enough now. A fine, clear grey, to see him perfectly. Perfectly composed, grave, and withdrawn. But his face was lined and old, colourless. Stephen took off his coat and then his shirt, folding it carefully.
"What are you doing?"
whispered Jack. "I always fight in my breeches. Cloth carried into a wound makes sad work, my dear."
The seconds paced out the ground, examined the pistols, and placed their men. A third closed carriage drew up. With the familiar butt and the balanced weight in his hand, Stephen's expression changed to one of extreme coldness. His pale eyes fixed with impersonal, lethal intensity upon Canning, who had taken up his stance, right foot forward, his whole body in profile. All the men there stood motionless, silent, concentrated as though upon an execution of a sacrament.
"Gentlemen," said Burke, "you may fire upon the signal."
Canning's arm came up, and along the glint of his own barrel, Stephen saw the flash, and instantly loosened his finger from the trigger. The enormous impact on his side and across his breast came at the same moment as the report. He staggered, shifted his unfired pistol to his left hand, and changed his stance. The smoke drifted away on the heavy air, and he saw Canning plain, his head high, thrown back with that Roman emperor air. The barrel came true, wavered a trifle, and then steadied. His mouth tightened, and he fired. Canning went straight down, rose to his hands and knees, calling for his second pistol, and fell again. His friends ran to him, and Stephen turned away. "Are you all right, Stephen?" He nodded, still as hard and cold as ever, and said to M'Alister, "Give me that lint." He mopped the wound, and while M'Alister probed it, murmuring, "Struck the third rib, cracked it, deviated across the stern, and the ball's awkwardly lodged, meant to kill you, the dog. I'll clap a cingulum about it." He watched the far group, and his heart sank. The wicked, reptilian look faded, giving way to one of hopeless sadness. That dark flow of blood under the feet of the men gathered round Canning could mean only one thing. He had missed his aim. M'Alister, holding the end of the bandage in his mouth, followed his glance and nodded. "Sub clavin, or aorta itself," he muttered through the cloth. "I'll just pin this end and step over for a word with our colleague." He came back and nodded gravely.
"Dead?"
said Etheridge, and looked hesitantly at Stephen, wondering whether to congratulate him. The look of utter dejection kept him silent. While Bondon drew the charge from the second pistol and ranged them both in their cases, Etheridge walked over to Burke. They exchanged a few words, saluted formally, and parted. People were already moving about the Maidan. The eastern sky showed red. Jack said, "We must get him aboard at once. Bondon, hail the carriage." Chapter 11. The tigers had gone, and servants were openly carrying things away. "Good morning, ma'am," said Jack, springing up. Diana curtsied. "I brought you a letter from Stephen Maturin." "Oh, how is he?" she cried. "Very low. A great deal of fever, the ball is badly lodged, and in this climate a wound..." "But you know all about wounds in this climate." Her eyes filled with tears. She'd expected hardness, but not this cold anger. He was taller than she'd remembered him, altogether bigger and more formidable. His face had changed. The boy, quite gone, vanished beyond recall. The hard, commanding eye. The only thing she recognized, apart from his uniform, was his yellow hair tied in a queue. And even his uniform had changed. He was a post-captain now. "You will excuse me, Aubrey," she said, and opened the note. Three straggling, uneven lines. "Diana, you must come back to Europe. The Lushington sails on the 14th. Allow me to deal with any material difficulties. Rely upon me at all times. I say at all times. Stephen." She read it slowly, and again, peering through the mist of tears. Jack stood, his back turned, looking out of the window with his hands behind his back. Beneath the anger and the distaste for being there, his mind was filled with questions, doubts, a hurry of feelings that he couldn't easily identify. Righteousness, except where faulty seamanship was concerned, or an offence against naval discipline, was unfamiliar to him. Was he a contemptible scrub, to harbour this enmity against a woman he had pursued? The severity that filled him from head to toe, was it an odious hypocrisy, fit to damn him in a decent mind? He'd gone near to wrecking his career in his pursuit of her. She had preferred Canning. Was this holier-than-thou indignation mere pitiful resentment? No, it was not. She'd hurt Stephen terribly. And Canning, that fine man, was dead. She was no good. No good at all. Yet that meeting under the trees could have taken place over the most virtuous of women, the world being what it was. Virtue. He turned it over, vaguely watching a horseman winding through the trees. He had attacked her virtue as hard as ever he could, so where did he stand? The common cant, "It is different for men," was no comfort. The horseman came in sight again, and his horse into full view. Perhaps the most beautiful animal he'd ever seen. A chestnut mare, perfectly proportioned, light, powerful. She shied at a snake on the drive and reared, a lovely movement, and her rider sat easy, kindly patting her neck. Virtue. The one he esteemed above all was courage, and surely it included all the rest. He looked at her ghost-like image in the window-pane. She possessed it. Never a doubt of that. She was standing there perfectly straight. So slim and frail, he could break her with one hand. A tenderness and admiration he had thought quite dead moved in him. "Mr. Johnstone," said a servant. I'm not at home. The horseman rode away. Aubrey, will you give me a passage home in your ship?
No, ma'am. The regulations do not admit of it. In any case, she's unfit for the lady, and I have another month and more of refitting.
Stevens asked me to marry him. I could act as a nurse.
I regret extremely. My orders will not allow it. But the Lushington sails within the week, and if I can be of any assistance, I should be most happy. I always knew you were a weak man, Aubrey, she said with a look of contempt. But I did not know you were a scrub. You're much the same as every man I've ever known, except for Maturin. False, weak, and a coward in the end.
He made his bow and walked out of the room with an appearance of composure. In the drive, he passed a cook, pushing a handcart loaded with brass pots and saucepans.
"Am I indeed a scrub?" he asked.
And the question tormented him all the way to Howrah, where the frigate lay. The moment he saw her tall mainmast high above the mass of shipping, he walked even faster, ran up the gangway, passed through the waiting officers and shipwrights, and went below.
"Killick," he said, "find out if Mr. McAllister is busy with the doctor. If he's not, I wish to see him."
Stephen was in the great cabin, the airiest, lightest place in the ship. There seemed to be a good deal of activity in there. McAllister came out with a drawing in his hand, followed by the boatswain, the carpenter, and several of their mates. He looked anxious and upset.
"How is he?" asked Jack.
"The fever is far too high, sir," said McAllister, "but I hope it will come down when we've extracted the ball.
We're almost ready now, but it's very badly placed."
"Should he not be taken to the hospital? Their surgeons could give you a hand. We can have a litter ready in a moment."
"I did suggest it, of course, as soon as we found the bullet right under the pericardium. Flattened and deflected, you understand. But he has no opinion of the military surgeons nor of the hospital. They sent to offer their assistance not half an hour since, and I confess I should welcome it. The pericardium, hoot, toot. But he insists on performing the operation himself, and I dare not cross him. You will excuse me now, sir. The armourer is waiting to make this extractor he's designed.
May I see him?"
"Yes, but pray do not disturb him or agitate his mind."
Stephen was lying on a series of chests, propped up, with his back against a thrum mat, the whole covered with sailcloth. Over against him, showing his naked chest in the fullest light, a large mirror, slung by a system of blocks and lines. Beside him, within reach, a table covered with lint, tow, and surgical instruments, crowbills, retractors, a toothed demi-lune. He looked at Jack and said,
"Did you see her?"
"Yes."
"I am deeply obliged to you for going."
"How was she?"
"Bearing up. She has all the spirit in the world."
"Stephen, how do you feel?"
"What was she wearing?"
"Wearing?
Oh, well, sort of dress of some sort, I suppose. I didn't attend."
"Not black?"
"No, I should have noticed that. Stephen, you look damnably feverish. Shall I have the skylight unshipped for air?"
Stephen shook his head.
"There is some little fever, of course, but not enough to cloud my mind to any degree. That may come later. I wish Bates would hurry with my Davier."
"Will you let me bring the Fort William man just to stand by? He could be here in 5 minutes."
"No, sir. I do this with my own hand."
He looked at it critically and said more or less to himself,
"If it could undertake the one task, it must undertake the other, that is, but justice."
M'Alister came back, holding a long-nosed instrument with little jaws, straight from the armourer's forge. Stephen took it, compared its curve with his drawing, snapped its levered beak, and said, "Cleverly made, neat, charming. M'Alister, let us begin. Pray call for Choules, if he's sober."
"Is there anything I can do?"
asked Jack. "I should very much like to help. May I hold a basin or pass the tow?"
"You may take Choule's place, if you wish, and hold my belly, pressing firmly thus when I give the word. But have you a head and a stomach for this kind of thing? Does blood upset you? Choules was a butcher, you know."
"Bless you, Stephen, I've seen blood and wounds since I was a little boy."
Blood he had seen, to be sure, but not blood. Not this cold, deliberate ooze in the slow track of the searching knife and probe. Nor had he heard anything like the grind of the demi-lune on living bone, a few inches from his ear as he leant over the wound, his head bent low not to obscure Stephen's view in the mirror. "You will have to raise the rib, M'Alister," said Stephen. "Take a good grip with the square retractor. Up! Harder! Harder! Snip the cartilage!" The metallic clash of instruments. Directions. Perpetual quick swabbing. An impression of brutal force beyond anything he had conceived. It went on and on and on. "Now, Jack. A steady, downward pressure. Good. Keep it so. Give me the Davia. Swab, M'Alister. Press, Jack, press!" Deep in the throbbing cavity, Jack caught a glimpse of a leaden gleam. It clouded, and there, half-focused, was the long-nosed instrument searching deeper and deeper. He closed his eyes. Stephen drew his breath and held it, arching his back. In the silence, Jack could hear the ticking of M'Alister's watch close to his ear. There was a grunt, and Stephen said, "Here she is. Much flattened. M'Alister, is the bullet whole?"
"Whole, sir, by God, quite whole, not a muscle left. Oh, brawly, feck it!"
"Easy away, Jack. Handsomely with the retractor, M'Alister. A couple of pledgets, and you may begin to sew. Stay. Look to the captain while I swab. Hartshorn, put his head down." M'Alister heaved him bodily into a chair. Jack felt his head pressed down between his knees, and the pungent Hartshorn searching his brain. He looked up and saw Stephen. His face was now perfectly grey, glistening with sweat. It was barely human. But somewhere about it there was a look of surly triumph. Jack's eye moved down to Stephen's chest, ploughed open from side to side, deep, deep, and white bone, bare. Then M'Alister's back hid the wound as he set to work. A competent back, expressing ease and a share in the triumph. Competent activity, short, technical remarks. And there was Stephen, his chest swatched in a white bandage, sponged, relaxed, leaning back with his eyes half closed.
"You took the time, M'Alister," he asked. 23 minutes just."
"Slow." His voice trailed away, reviving after a moment to say, "Jack, you will be late for your dinner." Jack began to protest that he should stay, but M'Alister put his finger to his lips and led him on tiptoe to the door. More of the ship's company than was right were hanging about outside it. Discipline seemed to have been forgotten. "The ball is out," he said. "Pullings, let there be no noise abaft the mainmast, no noise at all." and walked into his sleeping cabin.
"You look wholly pale yourself, sir," said Bondon. "Will you take a dram?"
"You'll have to change your coat, Your Honour," said Killick, "and your breeches, too."
"Christ, Bondon," said Jack. "He opened himself slowly with his own hands right to the heart. I saw it beating there."
"Ah, sir, here's surgery for you," said Bondon, passing the glass. "It wouldn't surprise any old Sophie, however, such a learned article. You remember the gunner, sir? Never let it put you off your dinner. He'd be as right as a trivet, never you fret, sir."
The dinner was a splendid affair, eaten off a blaze of gold. And without reflecting, he swallowed a pound or two of some animal aswim in a fiery sauce. His neighbours were affable, but after they had exhausted the common topics, they gave him up as a heavy fellow. And he made his way mutely through the succeeding courses, each with its own wine. In the comparative silence he heard the conversation of the two civilians opposite, the one a deaf and aged judge with green spectacles and a braying voice, the other a portly member of council. Towards the end of dinner they were both flushed and far from steady. Their subject was Canning, his unpopularity, his bold and independent activity.
"From all I hear," said the judge, "you gentlemen will be inclined to present the survivor with a pair of gold-inlaid pistols, if not a service of plate."
"I do not speak for myself," said the member of council, "since Madras is the scene of my labours. But I believe there are some here who will shed no tears in their mourning coaches."
"And what about the woman? Is it true they mean to expel her as an undesirable person? I should prefer to see a good old-fashioned flogging at the cart's tail. It's many years since I've had that pleasure, sir. Should you not itch to hold the whip? For undesirable person is only to be construed in the administrative sense in this case.
Buller's wife called to see how she was supporting her misfortune. She was not admitted, however."
"Prostrated, of course, I'm sure, quite prostrated. But tell me about the fire-eating Irish sawbones. Was the woman his—"
An aide-de-camp came up behind them and whispered between their heads. The judge cried,
"What? Hey? Well, I wasn't aware."
He brought his spectacles some way down his nose and peered at Jack, who said,
"You are speaking of my friend Dr. Matcham, sir. I trust the woman to whom you have referred is in no way connected with the lady who honours Matcham and me with her acquaintance?"
"No, no," they assured him. "They meant not the least offence to the gentleman, would be happy to withdraw any facetious expression, would never dream of speaking of a lady known to Captain Aubrey with disrespect. They hoped he would drink a glass of wine with them."
"By all means," said he. And presently the judge was led away.
The next day, on the padded quarter-deck of the Surprise, Jack received Diana with less rigour than she had expected. He told her that Maturin was sleeping at the moment, but if she chose to sit below with Mr. McAllister, she would learn all that could be learned about his state, and if Stephen woke, McAllister might let her in. He sent down all that the Surprise could offer in the way of refreshments. And when she went away at last, after a long, vain wait, he said, "I hope you'll have better luck another time. But indeed this sleep is the greatest blessing. It's the first he's had. Tomorrow I cannot get away. There's so much to be done. On Thursday, if I may?"
"Certainly.
And if any of my officers can be of use, we should be most happy. Pullings and Babington, you know, or Bondon for an escort. These docks are hardly the place for a lady."
"How kind.
I should be glad of Mr. Babington's protection."
"Lord Braithwaite,"
said Friday's Babington, double-shaved, shining in his gold-laced hat,
"how I love that Mrs. Villers.
Braithwaite sighed and shook his head.
She makes the rest look like brutes from Portsmouth Point.
I shall never look at another woman again, I'm sure. Here she comes. I see her carriage beyond the dhow.
He ran to hand her up the gangway and to the quarter-deck.
"Good day to you, ma'am," said Jack. "He's considerably better, and I'm happy to say he is at an egg. But there is still a great deal of fever, and I beg you will not upset or cross him in any way. Now, Alistair says it is most important not to cross him in any way."
"Dear Maturin," she said, "how glad I am to see you sitting up. Here are some mangosteens. They're the very thing for a fever. But are you sure you're well enough to see visitors? They frighten me so, Aubrey Pullings, Mr. McAllister, and now even Bondon, telling me not to tire you or vex you, that I think I should go almost at once."
"I am as strong as an ox, my dear," said he, "and infinitely recovered by the sight of you.
At all events, I shall try not to upset you or cross you in any way. First, let me thank you for your dear note. It was a great comfort, and I'm following your directions."
He smiled, and said in a low voice, "How happy you make me. But, Diana, there is the sordid aspect. Common requirements, bread and butter. In this envelope..."
"Stephen, dear, you are the best of creatures. But I have bread and butter, and jam, too, for the moment. I sold a thumping great emerald the Nizam gave me, and I've booked the only decent cabin in the Lushington. I shall leave everything else behind, just abandon it where it lies. The underbred frumps of Calcutta may call me names, but they shall not say I'm interested."
"No. No, indeed," said Stephen. "The Lushington. Roomy, comfortable, twice our size, the best sherry I've ever drunk. Yet I wish... You know, I wish you could have come home in the surprise. It would have meant waiting another month or so, but... You didn't think to ask Jack?"
"No, my dear," she said tenderly, "I did not. How stupid of me. But then there are the maids, you know, and I should hate you to see me seasick, green, squalid and selfish. It'll make little odds in the long run, however. I dare say you'll catch us up. We shall see one another at Madeira. Or at all events in London, it'll not be long. How parched you look. Let me give you something to drink. Is this barley water?" They talked quietly. Barley water, mangosteens, eggs, the tigers of the Sundarbans. Or rather, she talked, and he lay there looking grave, transparent, but deeply happy, uttering a word or two. She said, "Aubrey will certainly take great care of you. Will he make as good a husband as he does a friend, I wonder?"
"I doubt it. He knows nothing whatsoever about women.
Stephen, you're growing very tired. I shall go now. The Lushington sails at some impossible hour of the morning, at high tide. Thank you for my ring. Goodbye, my dear." She kissed him, and her tears dropped on his face. The fetid ooze of the Hooghly gave way to the clearer sea of the Bay of Bengal, to the right dark blue of the Indian Ocean. The Surprise, homeward bound at last, spread her wings to the monsoon and raced away southwestwards in the track of the Lushington, now 2,000 miles ahead. She carried a sodden, disgruntled, flabby crew, a steel box filled with rubies, sapphires, and pearls in chamois bags, a raving surgeon and an anxious commander. He sat the night watches through by Stephen's cot, ever since the fever had reached its present shocking height. McAllister would have spelled him, or any one of the gunroom, but delirium had unlocked Stephen's secret mind. And although much of what he said was in French or Catalan, or meaningless except in the context of his private nightmare, much was direct, clear, and specific.